All right, welcome to another episode of Locked On Bulls, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. I'm Sean Hyken of The Athletic. I'm one of the co-hosts of Locked On Bulls, obviously, and I am in Portland. I was just in L.A. for the Bulls back-to-back against the Clippers and the Lakers, and I recorded an episode today with Anthony Irwin, who is one half of the Locked On Lakers host on the Locked On Podcast Network. And we didn't talk a ton about the game on Sunday night that the Bulls won 118 to 110, but we talked more so about how these two teams are doing. They're both kind of doing better than expected. There's some similarities, some differences between them, and you know how we feel about these franchises going forward long term. It's a pretty interesting conversation. It's a little bit longer than a usual Locked On Bulls episode, so you know, hopefully you can bear with us, but I think it's worth listening to the whole thing. It was a pretty good conversation. Anthony's great. You should go follow him. Subscribe to Locked On Lakers if you're at all interested in the Lakers. As usual, you can subscribe to us at Locked On Bulls on iTunes. Make sure you leave us a 5-star review. You can also find us on Stitcher, TuneIn, Audio Boom, Google Play, anywhere you can find podcasts. You know the deal by now. Email us at lockedonbulls@gmail.com with any advertising inquiries or basketball questions. Follow us on Twitter at lockedonbulls. Like us on Facebook at lockedonbulls. Follow me on Twitter at Hyken. Follow Cody at Cody Westerland. Subscribe to The Athletic to read my work. Check out 670thescore.com to read Cody's work covering the Bulls. And enjoy this conversation between me and Anthony Irwin.
All right, so Sean, how's it going? How's the season treating you so far? The Bulls have been a lot of fun.
They have been fun. I actually just got back from LA yesterday. I was down there for the back to back with the Clippers and the Lakers. It was a little bit of a scene yesterday because I spent a lot of time out in LA Live area, and so the Lakers were playing at Staples last night, and then the American Music Awards were going on at the exact same time, and then, like, right down the street, the auto show was at the Convention Center. So the hotel lobby at the Marriott at LA Live was a lot of fun to watch.
Should we talk about basketball? Should we just give, you know, your experience of people watching at the Marriott?
I'm honestly, like, and I'm not proud of this. I'm so out of touch at this point with, like, who's even performing at any of these awards. I don't know who, like, a lot of the people are. I used to be a lot more up on this kind of stuff than I am. The one story that I have is I was sitting in the lobby, just kind of in the front on one of those couches that they have. And I don't know if you've ever been in the lobby of that hotel, but they have, like, couches right in the front. I was sitting there waiting to meet up with a friend for lunch. And a bunch of other people were sitting on the couch with me. And you know that band 21 Pilots?
Mm-hmm.
So one of the dudes from 21 Pilots, like, walked by outside, and every single other person that was sitting on the couches with me just, like, rushes up and goes outside. So,
huh. And you're just kind of sitting there like,
and oh, I'm just like, okay. I'm waiting for my friend to meet me. I don't really care about 21 Pilots. So, like,
yeah, I get myself into trouble just people watching. Like, I've been caught multiple times just I can't even help myself, you know. And then what's even worse is sometimes, you know, you'll see something going on there that's just that has to be tweeted about. So somebody will kind of, like, you know, they'll see you looking at them and then start talking, you know, texting on your phone, and then it's just a really awkward. What was the worst? Actually, we should probably talk about basketball.
I don't know what basketball is. No, this whole thing was and the other thing is, it rained in LA. I was told it never rained in LA. I hadn't been there in like 5 years. I was told it was just sunny year round. So I don't know what the deal is.
That had to be the worst day of driving in the history of Los Angeles yesterday, because it was like the first rain in a long time. You had all the traffic from all the things going on out there, and the people in LA can't drive as it is. So yeah, I hope you didn't do much driving yesterday.
I wasn't driving at all. I had some Ubers, so it wasn't too bad.
Yeah.
I did get to go to Roscoe's for the first time, which was cool.
Oh, yeah. That's what took so long? I mean, was that – how many trips
just,
did you
just
made
because
out?
I hadn't been to L.A. in like 5 years, so I had never really gone there before that. But so, yeah, I enjoyed my first trip to Roscoe's. I enjoyed the chicken and waffles very much.
That's – yeah, it's a mainstay.
It is.
You know. My wife, before I had met her, had never even had chicken and waffles. So, like, the first experience of chicken and waffles was Roscoe's, and it was her reaction was about as happy as I've ever seen her.
It's pretty great.
Mm-hmm. All right. So, what hasn't been great has been Luol Deng. It's been kind of sad, to be honest, because he is like the one thing that I'll note about Luol Deng is that he is about as professional as they get. You know, he came into the season and I was surprised at how quickly he said, like, it's about these kids and I want to try to make it work. And, you know, it's Brandon Ingram's spot is there for the taking when he's ready for it. It's just a matter of, you know, me teaching him while I can. And that took immense maturity for him to say that. I just didn't anticipate he'd be bad enough that people would be already ready for Brandon Ingram, who was not particularly ready as an NBA player offensively to start, you know, for an NBA team. And here we are. He's just, Deng has been that bad in terms of on-court production.
Yeah, and I mean, I think with Luol, when you're at the point that he's at in his career, he's 31, and it clearly his best years are behind him. I don't think he really put too much thought into what his role was going to be when he signed with the Lakers. I think there was a team that actually was willing to offer him a 4-year, $72 million deal, and he was just like, I'm in, let's just do that. But it was not really hard to see this coming with him, especially once he got like this long-term deal, because the last couple of years when he was in Miami, he was on a shorter-term deal, and he was, you know, he wasn't great in Miami, but he was a productive enough player. But the truth of the matter is, Anthony, that he just had so many miles on him from all the Tibbs years in Chicago that 2011-12, the lockout year, and 2012-13, both of those 2 years back-to-back, he led the league in minutes played per game. So he had a lot of miles on him. And then in the 12-13 playoffs, there was obviously that whole thing where he misses most of the playoffs because he has viral meningitis, and the Bulls medical staff says he's day-to-day, and he ends up having to have spinal fluid drained. And so that whole thing was a little bit weird. And then, you know, he gets traded to Cleveland the season after that, during the year after Derrick Rose goes down again. So his best years were definitely behind him. And when the Lakers brought him in, I don't think they thought that they were going to be getting like a full-time starter. They brought him in as as a veteran mentor or locker room guy, which, you know, I don't know if it's really the move to pay $72 million for a guy like that. But, you know, I only got to cover Lou for half a season in Chicago. My first year there was the year where it was the 13-14 year where he got traded in the middle of the year. So I didn't get to know him as well as I know some of the other guys on the team. But he is a great guy. He was always one of his most respected teammates among other guys in the locker room. He's always great about helping young guys. You talk to Jimmy Butler, that's a guy that he helped a lot early on in his career. He's going to be great for the young guys, but it's just, you know, if you're expecting him to contribute a lot on the court at this point, that's just not really realistic. And I mean, I guess they had to spend the money somewhere, but I agree with you. He has not been good. That's a very long-winded way of saying that.
It's been tough to watch, especially because he was never, to me, he was never the kind of athlete that, you know, jumped off the screen at you and said, oh my God, look at the stuff that he's doing. He was always really, really smart, and he, you know, used the athleticism that he had about as well as he could, and he was just really long. That's actually why I thought, you know, in terms of guys that Ingram could learn from, Deng is about as perfect a fit as there is, because if Brandon Ingram turns out to be Luol Deng and has Luol Deng's career, I would probably call it a win for Brandon.
Absolutely. He's a two-time All-Star. He was never like an MVP or anything. And I guess, you know, if you draft a guy number two overall, you kind of are hoping that a potential superstar emerges. And that's just, you know, it's usually not a realistic thing to expect. But yeah, if somebody at the end of their career says, I had Luol Deng's career, I think most players would take that any day.
Absolutely. And that's the thing. I actually had this conversation earlier or last week with Darius, and we were talking about D'Angelo Russell and the perception with him, because he was drafted number two overall as well. And out here in LA, the Lakers have had some, you know, some pretty good success drafting later in the, you know, later with guys, finding guys like,
right, like Larry Jordan Nance, Clarkson, Jordan Clarkson,
So that people just think it's like, oh, they're, those guys were as good as they are, and they were found late in the draft. Just imagine what it would be like to get the kind of talent at the top of the draft, you know, and it just, it doesn't work that way. And Yeah, when I watch Brandon Ingram play, I think he has a lot of the stuff that you would like to see defensively. Offensively, it's just going to take a while because he weighs 37 pounds.
Right. He's I mean, shout out to Brandon Ingram, because I'm a pretty skinny dude myself. So shout out to Brandon Ingram holding it down for all the skinny dudes out there. He's an inspiration to all of us.
It's so funny. Like
him and Will Barton.
You say, like, shout out to the skinny guy out there, and I'm like, shouts to Ray Felton.
Shouts to Ray Felton. Shouts to Boris Diaw, I guess. Shouts to
Zeebo. Like, those guys are my heroes.
If Big Baby were still in the league, shout out to Big Baby.
Yeah, exactly.
Shout out to Sean Kemp back in the day.
Yeah, it's for those who for those of people who have met Sean and then who've met myself. We do not look very much alike at all in terms of.
I've only met you once, I think, because I met you when we had dinner together in Vegas over the summer with the rest of the Locked On people who were out there.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and I pretty much ate the whole table. So,
right.
So what I was interested in talking to you about, you know, we talked about Luol Deng, but I was also interested in the dynamic of two teams that have pretty thoroughly outperformed expectations so far.
Yeah, and I think there's one kind of glaring similarity between these two teams and how they've looked so far, and it's obviously one of the people in question left the team that they were with a lot more beloved than the other one did. But you look at what the Lakers, like, I just from an outsider's perspective, everybody just seems like they're having so much more fun this year with, now that the cloud has been lifted of having to cater every single thing about the team to, you know, it being Kobe's farewell tour and having to make sure he gets all the shots that he wants to get because it's his last game in whatever city, or his last home game, or his last national TV game, or his last whatever. And, you know, you have to keep him happy, and you have to deal with all the media coverage that surrounds that. So I kind of feel like that's a little bit of what's going on with the Lakers. And then with the Bulls, like, when they traded Derrick Rose over the summer, everybody kind of knew he was going to be gone after this coming year anyway, because he was going to be a free agent, and there was just so much baggage at that point that it was hard to see them re-signing him, especially for the money that he wanted. But this year, and even putting aside the fact that he hasn't been that good in New York, so it hasn't really been, you know, like a huge loss for them on the court. Just not have, for me, as somebody who covers the team and is around the team every day, not going into practice, and I don't want to pile on Derek too much because obviously he didn't decide to get injured and he didn't decide to just not be able to be the same player that he was before, but not having to go into every single practice and have the first question be, is Derek going to play tomorrow? Did he practice? Is he healthy? What's his status? How many minutes can he play? It's just such a liberating thing that you don't have to deal with all the sideshows and then, you know, some of the stuff that he's said over the years about, like, his free agency and all that, that you just don't have to deal with anymore. And it's really liberating.
It absolutely is. And, you know, you use the cloud stuff. And I think, like, with both guys, people were kind of hesitant to talk about how tough their existence was for everybody else on the team. Like, while Derek was there, you weren't going to hear people too often. There were a couple, you know, things popping up from Jimmy Butler that were not directly tied to him or whatever, but there were some rumblings there. But well, and with so Kobe, if Jimmy, anybody
the
says...
Derek, just to jump in here, the Derek-Jimmy stuff, I think, was overblown. They weren't a great fit together on the court, obviously, because they're both very ball-dominant guys and they both need to have the ball in their hands. Off the court, I've just from being around them and knowing both of them a little bit, I don't think there's really any animosity between the two of them on a personal level. They always got along fine. Derek always got along fine with all of his teammates. I don't think he was disliked by anybody. There were some guys, some of the more veteran guys that Jimmy maybe rubbed the wrong way last year. But with Derek, it wasn't really a question of his teammates not liking him. It was just, there's just all this, it's just constantly something with him, whether it's he's out because of this injury or he's sitting out for precautionary reasons, or he says something that's taken the wrong way, or obviously, and that's just a whole other level of seriousness, but the off the court situation that he had during training camp, there's just always something with him.
Right. And it's the same thing. Now we could talk about we don't have to talk about the off court, the serious stuff that Derrick Rose was into and the serious stuff that Kobe went through.
I mean, I have my own personal thoughts about that case, but, you know, the legal process played out and he won the case, and that's kind of it at this point. But all I'll say is I was just so glad that that's not my problem anymore on a day-to-day basis.
And I would imagine, you know, and Kobe didn't have anything with this group of teammates, but with just like you said, it was always something with Kobe. It was always something that people wanted to make it with Kobe and make it about Kobe.
Right, because there was like a few years ago, it was like, oh, does he not get along with Dwight, or like, or you know, is he taking shots at Pau, or you know, some of the stuff, and you know, earlier, or even going back a little bit earlier, that even besides the Shaq stuff, which obviously has been well documented everywhere, but like. You know, he basically came out in the media and said, you know, we need to trade Andrew Bynum for Jason Kidd. And then he had his own trade demands where he actually was almost traded to Chicago. And there's all this stuff. But even last year, even if none of Kobe's teammates last year disliked him, the Lakers franchise, and I get that, you know, Kobe did everything he did for the franchise, won 5 championships, one of the greatest players of all time, all of that. But you have to think, I mean, for the long term, and I'm sure you guys have talked about this a million times on your podcast and just, you know, in general, like among Lakers people, but you have to think that franchise would be in such a better place if last year wasn't just focused on being the Kobe farewell tour, and guys like D'Angelo and Julius Randle and Jordan Clarkson were more allowed to just, you know, develop freely and be there to be themselves, and you had a coach who was a little bit more player friendly to young guys than Byron Scott and wasn't just kind of there to keep Kobe happy. Basically, exactly the kind of coach that Luke Walton is right now.
Right. The big thing that I always kind of come back to with Kobe and the effect that the farewell tour had on the kids is the Lakers heading into this year, heading into, you know, especially like the off season, they didn't know necessarily what they had, or they didn't have the kind of idea that you would like to have about some of the younger guys. Like, you know, you thought maybe Julius Randle was going to be pretty good, and then this year he's completely outperformed what people thought he was capable of. You thought you knew D'Angelo Russell had the talent, but you're not quite sure, you know, how he's going to handle being like the main dude. And
right, and then obviously after the whole thing with Nick Young with the Snapchat stuff, that didn't really help his case either. But I kind of agree with you, not knowing what you have, not only is that like not, you know, it makes it harder for the front office to do what they have to do to, you know, build around those guys so they don't know what they have. It also makes it a tougher sell to free agents. Now, I don't think the Lakers were ever in a million years going to get Kevin Durant anyway, but they asked for a meeting and he didn't even give them one. And I feel like that just even the process of getting a meeting might have gone differently if they had known more what they have out of their young guys and they would be able to go to his people and say, look, you know, we have D'Angelo Russell. This is what he is. This is what he looked like his rookie year. You know, this is what Julius Randle could be. This is how he could fit next to him. They don't know because they were playing so many veteran guys last year because they just wanted to placate Kobe on his farewell tour.
Right. Not just last year. It was the year before that, too, where Ronnie Price somehow was getting minutes to start the year instead of Jordan Clarkson. And that sentence sounds, you know, it sounded funny at the time. And now it's outright laughable, you know. So what I was going to say, though, was you know, we talked about the stuff, you know, the addition by subtractions that have gone on with the team. But I also think that can kind of take away from the good stuff that's gone. Like Fred Hoiberg completely, in my opinion, revitalized what I thought he was capable of as a head coach in the NBA. You know, he's just I thought there was some stuff that was going on last year, and every so often I kind of wonder about, you know, the usage of Mirotić and how that's going to work out over the extent of his time out there. But for the most part, Fred Hoiberg entering this year was probably among the top coaches people thought who might get fired at some point this year or at the end of the year. And now he has the Bulls, you know, I don't even think it's a question that he, you know, he makes it through the season.
Well, just to address that part of it, there was never a chance that Fred was going to get fired this season, no matter how this season went. He was never going to get fired during the season because he was, when you fire a coach that's as well respected as Tom Thibodeau was, which obviously that, you know, that split needed to happen. We've been over that a million times. You know, that was the relationship between him and the front office was really ugly by the end of it. That they needed to go their separate ways. But when you fire a coach that's as well respected as Tom was, and then you hire a college coach that's never coached in the NBA before without going through a whole coaching search, they didn't even interview any other candidates. Fred was Gar Forman's handpicked successor for a couple of years because they go way back to when Gar was an assistant coach at Iowa State when Fred played there in the 1990s. So this, like, there was such little process to the hire that firing him a year and a half into a 5-year contract after you replace somebody like Tom Thibodeau with him would just be a bad look. And then maybe, like, let's say that guy doesn't work out, then it's like, okay, you know, maybe the front office guys are next. So there was never a chance that Fred was going to get let go. But honestly, I still have no idea what kind of a coach Fred Hoiberg is at the NBA level. Obviously, last year was a complete disaster, and a big part of that was because they brought in a new coach that is basically the polar opposite in terms of style and demeanor and everything from Tom Thibodeau, but they kept the roster exactly the same. There were a couple of rookies that came in, but other than that, none of the veterans changed out. I think 13 of the 15 guys on the roster last year were the same guys that were on the roster the last year that Tom Thibodeau was the coach. So it was just not a good fit because they were all guys that had been together for a lot of years and they were used to playing one way and then they have to start playing a different way. And Fred Hoiberg had such a different personality. No, you're not better or worse. That's not my judgment to make, but just a very different personality from Tom Thibodeau. He's more laid back.
Extremely.
You really couldn't have two more opposite coaches in terms of personality than those two. And so asking that same group to make an adjustment and basically have the same success was always unrealistic. And this year, I still think that the roster that the front office gave Fred is not ideal for the style that he wants to play. But I don't know how much of, you know, those fit questions are Fred's fault and how much of that is just a lot of these young guys are really unproven, but they have a bunch of veterans, like a guy like Dwayne Wade or Rajon Rondo didn't come here to get into this rebuilding situation. So they can't play these young guys too much. They still have to rely a lot on their starters, especially once they made the decision not to trade Jimmy Butler over the summer when they had a couple of offers for him on draft night. So it's still kind of a weird roster. I think it might be a couple more years before we really know definitively what kind of a coach Fred Hoiberg is.
Right. And I guess the way I would look at it after hearing that, the way I would kind of look at it is you went from Fred Hoiberg being a coach who was going to stick around, not necessarily for the best reasons. And now I'm looking at it and I while there are still questions like you're talking about with what he can actually bring to a team, you feel better about, you know, okay, he's at least there for the right reasons. He seems to make, you know, to be making steps forward. And, you know, when you it's kind of tough because Luke Walton stepped into such an easier situation where Tom Thibodeau is as respected as he is. And then Byron was Byron and is, you know, pretty widely renowned among people who I've spoken to is among the worst coaches that, you know, they've seen. And I've definitely seen. And so with Luke, you know, you're looking at, hey, it's just so long as you aren't actively hurting the team's chances of winning, you can stick around. And I think Hoiberg stepped into a tougher situation there following somebody as like you said, as respected and as good, just flat out good as Thibodeau is.
Right. And I think the thing that's made Luke Walton so effective in LA, and we saw this, you know, the first half of last year at Golden State when what were they, 39-4 before Steve Kerr came back from his back surgery when Luke was the interim coach. But the thing that's made Luke so effective in my mind is he's just able to relate. I mean, you look at obviously what Byron Scott was, and Byron like would openly admit that he didn't even talk to D'Angelo Russell because D'Angelo hadn't earned the right to communicate with him directly. Like, that's actually a direct quote, which is just when you just drafted a kid number two overall to be Kobe Bryant's successor, like, that's not the way you want to treat him, even if, you know, maybe he is a little bit raw and a little bit immature. You want to be able to work with him. And I think Luke has done such a good job of getting guys in a weird way. It's pretty similar to what Tom Thibodeau was so successful at when he was in Chicago, even though Luke is obviously much more laid back coach than Tom was and a lot less demanding. But the reason that guys never really checked out on Tom, even as hard as he was to deal with at times, was because they always knew that if they put in the work, he was going to have their back. I never heard him throw a player under the bus in his entire time there. He defended Derrick Rose at every single step in terms of sitting out or, you know, some of the pressure that was on him to come back. Tom, it would have been very easy for Tom to kind of say, well, we expect everybody to play if they're healthy. Like, he defended him at every single time. And I think that was something that resonated with a lot of guys. And I think Luke Walton is the same way. Like, he understands that, you know, these are all young kids on this Lakers team. They're not going to be perfect right out of the gate. They're going to have to learn. They're going to have to play through mistakes. But as long as they're doing the right things, as long as they're not making the same mistakes twice, and they are coming in every day and putting in the work, he's going to defend them and say and not throw them under the bus the way that Byron did with some of the young guys last year. And when you, from a player's standpoint, when you have a coach that's like that, that's willing to let you kind of learn by experience and not expect you to be perfect right away, you're willing to play a lot harder for him than you do somebody like Byron Scott, where you know that unless you're Kobe Bryant, nothing that who's held to a completely different standard, nothing you do is going to be good enough for him.
That was the big thing when you said the different standards that, and it wasn't just Kobe. Like,
it was mostly last year, Kobe.
Well, oh no, yes, it was definitely mostly Kobe. But I'm saying the standards that veterans were being held to were just completely different than the standards that, you know, kids were being held to defensively, especially where, you know, Byron was out there yelling at people, man up, man up, man up, man up, man up. And, you know, eventually that starts falling on deaf ears. And, you know, he's questioning guys' ability to adjust to the NBA, to play defense in the NBA. And then you look over and you see, like, Lou Williams playing much of the same, if not worse, defense than D'Angelo Russell played last year. And Lou Williams at no point was questioned for his, you know, at his defensive toughness and his, you know, his motor or his maturity or anything like that, the way D'Angelo Russell consistently was by Byron. And yeah, that kind of stuff lingers with players. And it's why these guys have, like,
Jordan Clarkson. Nick Young is an NBA player again.
Right. Well, Jordan Clarkson literally said the other day that he would run through a wall for Coach.
Yeah.
And he called him Coach. Like, it was, you know, that's kind of a pet peeve with me, you know, guys calling coaches by their first names. He said, like, I would run through a wall for Coach. Nick Young is out there saying, you know, Baxter Holmes just wrote a really good article.
I read that.
Profile on Nick Young. And yeah, Nick Young knew how close he was to being done with the Lakers, if not the NBA as a whole. And
he was going to get bought out and then probably have to go play in China or something after what happened last year. Because you kind of thought that after the thing that happened with him and D'Angelo with the Snapchat, which either directly or indirectly resulted in Swaggy's relationship with Iggy Azalea ending, like, you kind of think there's no way they can be teammates again, but then nobody in the world is going to want to trade for Nick Young with that contract that he's got and how ineffective he was last year. And so they'd either have to just buy him out and eat the money, or he would just, like, leave and go to China or something, or go somewhere else. And yeah, his career was over, but now he looks like a rotation player again. And it seems like, you're obviously a lot closer to it than I am, but it seems like he and D'Angelo are even getting along now.
He's Nick Young. Julius Randle called Nick Young the best teammate he's ever had.
That's amazing. He was on the same team as Kobe for 2 years. That's incredible. That's so great. No, I didn't see that quote. I love that so much, though, that Swaggy has a better relation, like, reputation as a teammate than Kobe does. That's hilarious.
So yeah, and yeah, the thing with Luke, and somebody, Haralabob, was tweeting about, you know, what Luke Walton brings and if he's ever seen somebody revitalize their career the way Nick Young has. And it's intangible. There's no way for me to actually, you know, statistically prove this. But Luke Walton lets Nick Young be Nick Young. Whereas when Nick Young would do Nick Young things under Byron Scott, you know, he'd immediately get benched, and then he would probably, you know, hear about it through the media that his coach didn't like seeing that from a guy on a bad team, right? And from a guy like Nick Young wouldn't want to hear that from a coach who is just as responsible, if not more responsible, for the Lakers being bad than Nick Young was, right? So when Luke Walton gets there and, you know, empowers Nick Young with the responsibility of, hey, not only am I just going to challenge you to be better defensively, but I'm going to challenge you and reward you with, I'm going to make sure at every point this preseason, Luke Walton was out there singing Nick Young's praises defensively, and people kind of laughed about it. And the cynical part of me said,
right.
Yeah, let's up his trade value. But for Nick Young, I, you know, based on how Nick responded to it, he feels like that was legitimate. Yeah, he completely bought in, and he believed Luke Walton at his word when he said those kinds of things.
Right. It's sort of like, you know, the idea of, wow, Nick Young is a defensive stopper now. It's sort of like the idea that, you know, Dwayne Wade is suddenly a 3-point shooter, which is apparently a thing. And I think it's actually might be a thing.
Is it really?
Well, every single day in practice, Fred Hoiberg, who obviously was a pretty good shooter during his own NBA career, has been spending time working with Wade on his form. And he's been helping him, you know, shoot, because before he came in, Fred told us this, that he watched a bunch of film on Wade's shooting before Wade came in over the summer, And, you know, Wade used to shoot his threes the same way he would shoot his fadeaways. And so Fred actually, like, gave him the stuff about his form to correct. And now he's not taking a ton of threes, but he's taking better shots now, and he's making them at a more consistent rate, which I don't think he's going to be shooting. Let me look up what he's actually shooting right now from three. It's probably something totally unsustainable. But he's right now on the season, he is shooting he's shooting 37.8% from three. That's, if he can just stay around 35, to where you have to at least put somebody on him, that's a huge win for the Bulls, considering how little else they have in terms of reliable shooters.
The thing, I'm a nerd about shooting form, so I'm actually looking forward to keeping an eye out and going and looking, maybe watching side by side at you know, the shooting form while he was in Miami to what he's doing now. But yeah, and again, it's really easy to overinflate coaching when expectations are exceeded, right? Because, you know, it's tough to, especially with the sample sizes that we're looking at in the NBA so far, it's tough to tangibly or statistically prove whatever is going on, you know, and why teams are playing better. So you just kind of say, like, oh yeah, it's totally coaching.
Well, in the Bulls' case, it's not the coaching. It's because of somebody, but it's not because of Fred Hoiberg.
Well, so what I was going to say, though, with, you know, Fred Hoiberg, usually the head coach just kind of assigns a shooting coach. They hire a shooting coach to work with whoever on the shooting. Right. And, you know, for Dwayne Wade, it's kind of like, wow, the head coach is over here giving me, you know, helping me out with my shot. And if he's seeing results, then that, I would imagine, helps him buy in just a little bit more, although veterans tend to buy in kind of regardless of the situation. Well, especially somebody like Dwayne.
Right, and I think the other thing with a guy like Dwayne, he's a very proud guy, and obviously he's heard all this stuff over the years of, oh, he can't shoot, and once his athleticism goes, he's going to be done. And I think he's really enjoying, like to him, it's a game to prove people wrong about, you know, what he can do. And he's a smart enough player that I think he understands that he's not going to, he can still get to the basket like he used to sometimes. He just can't do it every night for as many minutes as he did maybe 5 or 6 years ago, you know, when he was at his peak. But I think he's smart enough to understand that in order to stay effective and stay in the league for a long time, he's going to have to evolve his game in the way that, I mean, you look at a guy like Allen Iverson, he never learned how to shoot, so once the athleticism was gone, he was just done. I think, yep, Dwayne Wade is smart enough that he realizes that that's going to happen to him if he doesn't evolve his game, so maybe he's never going to become an elite three-point shooter, but if he can become good enough to where he can at least knock it down when he has it, or it's just another thing he has in his arsenal, so he doesn't always have to try to blow by people when in a few years he won't be able to do that at all anymore, you know, it's going to extend his career, and I think he knows that.
What's the ceiling for the Bulls? Like, we're, you know, given what, because the Lakers are kind of forced a bunch of people out here to rethink what they think the Lakers are capable of. So, like, I had the Lakers at about 27 to 30 wins heading into the year, and I think now it might be closer to like 33.
You still don't see them as a playoff team?
No, not quite. And we're going to find out, because the Lakers, you know, starting with playing the Spurs the other day and then the Bulls yesterday, they play like 12 straight games other than the Pelicans. They play 11 out of 12 games against playoff caliber teams. And this is where people are going to start realizing, okay, reality is kind of setting in, and we'll see where this takes them. Now, they could, again, they've proved me wrong to this point. But this is a tough stretch, you know. This and they have one stretch where they play, you know, 4 games and 5 nights on the road. That's just good luck, you know.
So I'm with you in terms of, you know, you said you were lower on the Lakers, and they've surprised you. That's absolutely the case with me and the Bulls. I was even a little bit higher on them than some of my colleagues who cover the team here in Chicago, but. You know, a few of them were saying they didn't think they were going to make the playoffs. But I think, so when Cody and I did our official, like, on the record predictions for the season, like the day before the season started on Locked on Bulls, which, I mean, if you want to go back and find that episode, you can. I don't remember exactly which day it was, but Cody had them not in the playoffs. I had them with the exact same record they had last year, 42-40, and I thought that was going to be just good enough for them to get the 8th seed. I thought they'd be just in a group of teams that was fighting to either get the 8th seed or, you know, maybe barely miss out in the playoffs, just like they did last year where they were 9th or 10th in the East. I think they're pretty solidly assuming like basically assuming like Jimmy Butler and all, you know, all their key guys stay healthy, I think they're pretty solidly, I can pretty solidly say I think they're definitely a playoff team. And I think they might even be able to get to as high as a 5 or a 6 seed. And I don't think that's as much about how good the Bulls are or are not, but just how the a lot of these other teams in the East are so much worse than I thought they would be. Because obviously, because so if you look at, you know, who's in the East that's in the playoff picture, obviously Cleveland is head and shoulders above everybody else. But then you've got behind them, you've got Atlanta, Toronto, and Charlotte that I think have looked a lot better than the Bulls so far. And then, you know, Boston has been shaky, but, you know, now that they've got Crowder and Horford back, I think they're going to be better. So that's 5 teams. I think the Bulls are definitely better than the Knicks. I think they're definitely better than the Pacers have been. I think they're definitely better than the Wizards, who I thought were going to be a lot better, and they've been awful so far. So many of these other teams, I see a lot more flaws than I do with the Bulls. And so I think the Bulls are pretty solidly a playoff team.
How much do you think, because, you know, there's a tendency, especially because basically everybody I follow is a blogger. Journalists, you know, don't do as much analysis of this kind of thing. And the blogosphere tends to, like, if they see a team that doesn't exactly abide by, you know, the analytics and the pace and space and, you know, going for corner three-pointers, you know, that kind of thing, then they kind of get discounted more than I think they should. And I think that's kind of what was going on with the Bulls, where you're kind of looking at a team, you're looking at Jimmy Butler, you're looking at Rajon Rondo, you're looking at Dwayne Wade, and you're saying, well, wait, where's the spacing going to come from? And I think that that was too overblown now that we have, you know, just under a quarter of the season behind us.
Right, and I mean, I think it's very true that, and I'm certainly guilty of this myself, the Bulls don't really fit into any specific model of, oh, this is, you know, this is like a Memphis Grizzlies type, just, you know, inside, you know, pounded in the paint, just grind it out on defense type of team. But it's also not a Warriors type, like they're just going to kill you with three-point shooting. They don't fit into any one of those boxes. But the thing about this Bulls team that is, they just have so many smart players on the team. Like, they probably, I mean, if there was an actual way to tangibly measure basketball IQ, I just figure, you know, between Rajon Rondo and Dwayne Wade and like Taj Gibson and Robin Lopez and some of these guys who are on the team, like, they would probably, they're like, a lot of these guys that are playing a lot of minutes are just off the charts smart, and they know how to pick their spots, they know how to make plays for guys even if it doesn't look pretty at times. And the other thing is, I just think that, and I'm certainly guilty of this too, people who thought the Bulls were going to be a lot worse than they've been, I think we underestimated the impact in the locker room of having a guy like Dwayne Wade come in. Because obviously there were some issues with Jimmy Butler last year trying to assert himself as the leader of the team when he was obviously the best player on the team, but it was still sort of Derrick Rose's team because he was that former MVP and still trying to get back from the injuries. But then some guys like Joakim Noah were a little bit resentful of Jimmy coming in, having been the 30th pick in the draft and trying to be the vocal leader now. And so there was some concerns about that, but having a guy like Dwayne Wade come in, and Dwayne did such a smart political thing at his introductory press conference back in July. He came out right at the start and said, look, this is Jimmy Butler's team. Jimmy Butler is the go-to guy. He's the best player on the team. And so he's not, right away, he put to rest any of the notions that, oh, these guys are going to fight over who's the man or who's going to get the ball. Like, Dwayne Wade came out and said, look, this is, we're, you know, Jimmy Butler is our star. He's our franchise player. And then, but then at the same time, in the locker room, Dwayne Wade is the guy that everybody goes to and gets advice from because he's Dwayne Wade. He's a future Hall of Famer. He's one of the best players of his generation. He's a finals MVP. He's all this stuff. And Jimmy Butler respects Dwayne Wade so much that he's never played with a teammate of that caliber in terms of what he's accomplished and what his stature in the league is. And so he just respects Dwayne Wade so much that he's willing to defer to him on off-court stuff and learn from him as far as like how to preserve his body and how to work and that kind of stuff. And it's just been a dynamic that I think a lot of people underestimated. You look, you know, so much at the on-court fit in a vacuum of, oh, well, Dwayne Wade can't shoot and Rajon Rondo can't shoot. Having a guy like Dwayne Wade on the team is just transformative for, you know, just the culture.
Yeah, and again, like, there's this tendency among, you know, the analytical people, you know, the people who pay attention. And I love analytics. I really, just information. They're really, really, you know, it's information. Why wouldn't anybody not want information?
No, I think you and I are in the same boat. I'm not like one of these nylon calculus dudes who's like making up my own metrics or stuff. But I mean, I use the stuff. I use per 100 possession stuff. I use a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. But my one criticism of the analytics movement is when there's something that you can't calculate, it's just ignored altogether.
Right.
And culture and chemistry and the human element to the stuff, that stuff that can't be calculated, and so it goes either ignored altogether or at the very least just, you know, kind of pushed off to the side. Like, okay, yeah, cool story, but let's actually figure out what's going on there, you know. And yeah, when you add somebody like Dwayne Wade, who is as professional as he is, and then you see him buying in, you know, the stuff that you talked about earlier with Hoiberg teaching him how to shoot – It could be very easy for somebody of Dwayne Wade's ilk, you know, and somebody who's had the career that Dwayne has had, to listen to that and say, all right, coach, thanks, but I'm going to keep shooting the way I've shot for the last, you know, 16 years and continue to be one of the best players of all time at my position, you know. And the fact that he didn't do that and he bought in and he's now seeing the results of that, that's the kind of thing that, you know, the rest of the roster looks at and says, yeah, all right, I'll buy into Fred as well, you know, and that's kind of cool.
It is. And right. Like you said, you know, he could just come in and be like, look, I'm Dwayne Wade. I don't need to listen to anybody, but he's not. And he's such a pro on and off the court. He's unselfish. He says, I mean, I will just say selfishly as a reporter, I have never enjoyed covering a player as much as I enjoy covering Dwayne Wade. There was this one, time during training camp, Anthony, that, the Cavs, the day before a preseason game against the Cavs, and the preseason game ended up being like literally the most pointless basketball game I've ever covered, because it was like right before J.R. Smith actually got his deal done, but the Cavs just, they had played the night before in Cleveland, and everybody that you've heard of on their roster not only wasn't playing, but wasn't even in the building. So like LeBron wasn't there, Kyrie wasn't there, Kevin Love wasn't there, Tristan, like everybody you've heard of, they were literally starting like Kay Felder and like a bunch of the D-League guys that were on their training camp roster. So, yeah. But mm-hmm. The day before that game, just because it's the Cavs and everybody knows how tight LeBron and Wade are, Wade spent 20 minutes after practice the day before that game just talking about how close he and LeBron had gotten to going to Chicago in 2010 when they were free agents the first time. And basically they wanted to go there and Wade wanted to have them go there. But the reason they ended up going to Miami was because Miami was the only team that could have the cap space to sign all three of them, and Chicago wouldn't have been able to do that. But he talked about that, and he talked about like the legacy of the Heat super team, and he talked about you know, what he thought about Kevin Durant going to the Warriors and just all this stuff. I got like four stories just out of that. And like, and the thing with Wade is that maybe it's because his wife is an actual celebrity who's more famous to non-sports fans than he is, but he loves like the celebrity aspect of it. He loves the media attention. He loves holding court and telling us like his thoughts on stuff and giving perspective, and he knows how to play the game from that sense. It's delightful to cover.
Yeah, he's reached that point.
Kobe was the same way towards the end of his end of his career. Like he knows that you know, if he gives people just these great quotes and just tells great stories about like, oh, I remember when this one play from this game in my third season when like Doug Christie went out, like, he tells some specific story like that. He knows that everybody's going to eat it up, and then that's going to make him look better by comparison. Like that's this kind of the stage of his career that Dwayne Wade has gotten to, where he just loves giving out the quotes and he loves the attention and he loves being looked at as the elder statesman who is just a guy that everybody looks to.
Yeah,
he's won three championships. He doesn't have to prove anything to anybody as far as being a player anymore.
Yeah, I love it when superstars get to that point where they say like, okay, yeah, I probably shouldn't say the dumb stuff out there, but for the most part, I've been way too clean to this point, so I'm just going to say, you know, kind of what comes to mind.
Right, like Dwayne Wade, during training camp, he said that it's unrealistic for the Bulls to expect to be competing for a championship, and then a couple weeks ago when the circus trip started, he said that a successful road trip would be 3-3. Any player who doesn't have Dwayne Wade's stature would get killed for not saying, oh yeah, I think we're going to compete for a championship or
championship
whatever.
Or bust.
But,
yeah.
But right, like anybody else would have gotten killed, but because Dwayne Wade has done so much in his career and he's been around and he's so much looked at as one of the smartest people in the league that he can say something like that and it's just like, oh, this is great veteran perspective and he's just being realistic.
It's funny, I you mentioned this earlier about, and we could ramble forever, but you mentioned the Jimmy Butler, Dwayne Wade kind of situation where Dwayne comes in and says, I'm not the superstar. Jimmy is the superstar. That's, you know, that's the future of this franchise. That's the cornerstone of this franchise. And it immediately brought to mind when Dwight Howard came to LA, how Kobe went out of his way to say, look, we could split responsibilities and leadership responsibilities and this and that, the other. And he's like, that's all bull crap. I'm the leader. This is my squad.
Right. And, you know, for as much crap as Dwight took for not getting along with Kobe, Kobe didn't exactly make it easy for him.
No. So I'm not saying that it's there's a right or a wrong way, but you can't help but notice
that. Well, right. You're seeing that Lakers year was a disaster. You're seeing the results of this Bulls year. Like, they very easily could have just devolved into fighting about, like, oh, who's going to get more shots? Who's going to get the ball? Dwayne Wade comes in and he's a Hall of Famer. He needs shots, but Jimmy Butler is the one who's in his prime right now. But Dwayne Wade has come in and said, like you said, he's come in and just said, no, look, I'm past my prime. Jimmy's in his prime. He's our go-to guy. And that's made all the difference. And now when the guy – and again, this goes back to a guy like Dwayne Wade comes in and says that every single player on the Bulls has never played with a player as good as Dwayne Wade in their entire careers. So – except, I guess, Rondo played with Garnett. But, like, you know what I mean. You know what I mean. For most of these guys, there's so many young guys on this team. They've never played with a player like Dwayne Wade. So when he comes in and says, look, Jimmy Butler's the guy, everybody else is sort of forced to say, okay, Jimmy Butler's the guy.
Yep, absolutely. And at the end of the day – I enjoy stories like, you know, when one team outperforms expectations, there's usually another team on the other side of it that are underperforming. For me, I the more good teams and the more good stories there are in the NBA, the more fun the NBA is to cover. So when I'm watching the Bulls play, and last night it was let's just go ahead and say that last night's ending wasn't exactly smooth for either team.
No, it wasn't. The Bulls definitely did everything they could to give that game a win. The Lakers were like, nah, we're good. You guys take it.
Yeah, you guys got this. So, you know, you're watching that going on, but I also can't help but look at, you know, when the Bulls and the Lakers are playing, like, both fan bases are thrilled with the way this year goes. And the more thrilled fans they are, the easier our job becomes.
No, absolutely. And it's also it's also just like easier. It's not just the fans are happy. It's easier for us when the players, when they're winning and they're loose and they're in a good mood and they're willing to talk to us. Last year was so miserable to cover for the Bulls just because, I mean, obviously with you guys, you had a different, you know, you basically had to spend the whole year just writing whatever Kobe said at every final press conference in X city that he was playing in. But for the Bulls last year, it was just the most miserable team because, like, everybody was so checked out and nobody was buying into Hoiberg. And Jimmy said that thing in the December about him needing to coach them harder. And so everybody else kind of checked out. And Joakim was checked out the whole year because he wasn't happy about coming off the bench. And Powell was checked out because he was in a contract year and he knew that this team wasn't going to win a championship. And so it was just ugly all around. You go in there, nobody talks to each other. And it was actually last year, after the Bulls didn't make the playoffs, I went home to Portland, which is where I grew up, and I covered the Blazers-Clippers series in the first round. And it was amazing. This the contrast going into the Blazers practice and going into the Blazers locker room before some of those playoff games, and guys on the team were just like joking around with each other and playing music and talking, and like it seemed like they actually enjoyed being around each other. Whereas like in the Bulls locker room all last year, there would barely be anybody in the locker room. Guys would just come in, get their stuff. Everybody always had headphones on. There was no real interaction or any kind of camaraderie that you could see, and it just made for a miserable experience. Obviously the team wasn't very good, but just covering them, because everybody just was going through the motions in terms of saying what they needed to say about, you know, we have to buy in more, we have to communicate better. This year they're winning. I mean, we'll see, maybe they go on a losing streak at some point, but like, well, you know, they're winning and everybody's in a good mood and everybody's happy, and it's just a lot more fun to cover.
Yes, absolutely. And I completely agree. Now, I wasn't in the locker room with the Lakers last year, but you could just tell, like, when you get the coach speak, when you get the, you know, the cookie cutter quotes, you know that players aren't exactly having a great time. This year, like we talked about earlier, Julius Randle called Nick effing Young his best teammate that he's ever had, you know, and you get Jordan Clarkson saying that he would run through a wall for coach, and you get the other stuff that the Lakers are saying and the Bulls are saying about themselves and their season so far, and yeah, it speaks volumes about where both teams are kind of going. I guess we'll wrap up on this. I I asked Fred Katz this on the show before this, if, you know, over the next 5 years, which franchise he'd rather have between the Thunder and the Lakers. I guess I'll ask you the same one. With the Bulls or the Lakers, not the Thunder or the Lakers.
Oh, God, I would take the Lakers in a heartbeat.
You just think?
Absolutely. Just because – so, I mean – right now, this is going great for the Bulls right now. But Dwayne Wade's 35. This isn't gonna. He's 34. He's gonna be 35 soon. This part isn't gonna last forever. They really don't have it. Besides him, they don't really have. We haven't really talked about a lot of the young guys on the Bulls roster yet. But they don't really have any sure thing, like long term sure things on the roster outside of Jimmy Butler. Because if you go down the line, it's all, you know, Mirotić has been inconsistent. McDermott is a good shooter, but he isn't really doing a lot else. MCW, we don't know what he's going to look like. Jerry and Grant, we don't know what he's going to look like. There's nobody on the team besides Jimmy Butler that you can look at and say, this is definitely a guy that you want to build around long term. The Lakers have three or four of those guys, and they're also. I mean, I know the Bulls got Dwayne Wade this summer, but that was the first time in their franchise history that they've actually gotten a high-level free agent, and that was, you know, a lot of extracurricular stuff with Pat Riley lowballing him and this other stuff. The Lakers, once the Lakers are back to being a little bit more of a respectable franchise than they have been the last couple of years and a little bit less dysfunctional, the Lakers are going to be a team that can get free agents because they're the Lakers and they can put out their history of, you know, we have these championship banners and we have this young core, and once this young core develops a little bit more, then... You know, obviously they weren't going to get Kevin Durant, and they're not going to get any of the guys that are going to be up the next couple of summers. But, you know, in 3 years, what if, like, Paul George or John Wall or somebody's a free agent and looks at the Lakers and say, you know, I really like this core that they have that's developed for a couple of years. I want to go there. I think there's more of a potential for that with the Lakers than there is for the Bulls. So that's how I would answer that question.
I would agree with basically everything you just said. Now the one thing that Fred said regarding the Thunder was that they have the superstar. They definitely have him right now. So you kind of bet on the superstar.
And Jimmy Butler is a better player right now than anybody on the Lakers roster. But the thing is, you know, with Jimmy, it's exactly the same thing that we were talking about earlier with Luol Deng. He has played a lot of minutes in his career. He's 26 now. He's young enough that he can handle that, but. Is he a guy in five? Like he has 3 years, counting this year, he has two more years. He can opt out in 2019. In 2019, he will be 29. Are you really going to feel great about giving him like a 5-year max deal with the amount of miles that he has on him already and thinking he's not going to break down the way that like Luol Deng has or that Joakim Noah has? That would be my one worry with Jimmy Butler. And frankly, even though we're talking about the Thunder, that would be my worry with giving Russ a long-term deal, too, as amazing as he is, and he's one of my favorite players to watch in the league as he is anybody else's, but he has had some pretty serious injuries in the past, and I think once the athleticism goes, he's going to lose a part of his game. So I would definitely, in both the Bulls and the Thunder's case, I would take the Lakers over the next 10 years over them in terms of which franchise, you know, building blocks I'd rather have.
Yep, So... It's interesting. I'm looking forward. The Lakers play the Bulls again in the coming weeks.
Yeah, I will be there December or November 30th.
So that, you know, it'll be, you know, I think the Lakers are coming off of a back-to-back in that one. I forget. But so were the Bulls when they played the Lakers in this case or in the last game. So it's a fun matchup between the two teams because of the styles. Like, you know, styles make matchups. And,
well, you have
and
to
the
keep
Lakers
in mind also Wade didn't play last night. He was sitting out.
Mm-hmm. And Rondo played about as well as I've seen Rondo playing.
Yeah, that was
while.
Definitely one of the better Rondo games of the year. He has not been that good.
No, and I don't know if he's necessarily consistently good as an NBA player anymore, but that's just me. Right. All right. Well, this was a lot of fun, Sean. Let's do this again sometime.
Yeah. Hit me up anytime. We'll do this. This was good.
Absolutely.